All right, I'm here today again with Yue Zhang. This is our last day, third day. It's going to be the fifth tape, side one. This is Bill Van Benschoten. Last time we spoke about, or you spoke about, the evolution of your research and coming to UNC at Chapel Hill. That brings us roughly to, you know, the last couple of years, recent past, sort of starting in 1993. We talked a little bit about the startup of your lab and your present focus on cell cycle control and tumor suppression. Could you give us a brief overview then of your current research projects that you're doing?
Right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, the current research was a continuation or further development from what I started 7 years ago since I arrived at UNC Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. We are currently involved in three different areas of research. All of them are aimed at understanding of mechanism controlling the cell division cycle and how the tumor developed. In short, called the cell cycle control and the tumor suppression. Mm-hmm. The first area is a continuation on understanding of in vivo function of CDK inhibitor genes. So more specifically, and we now know that there are seven distinct genes encoding CDK inhibitors that function by inhibiting cell cycle progression. So in other words, there are seven different breaks in the cells that mm-hmm. could stop cell cycle. At any one point, if cell activate one CDK inhibitor gene, it's generally believed it's sufficient to cause cell cycle rest. Then question becomes, why would the cell evolve to have seven different breaks or seven different inhibitor genes? So that's the question we want to understand. And in that front, we are at a stage, and I would say we understand very well by now the biochemical property and the in vitro function of those genes. But what we do not know, or we know very little still, is what they're doing in vivo at the physiological conditions. So what we're doing today is to take a genetic approach by knocking the function of individual CDK inhibitor genes, asking what's the phenotype developed in the mice lacking individual CDK inhibitor genes. Mm-hmm. The second area I've been working on is a so-called off MDM2 PB3 pathway. And that was closely related to the first one. Actually, it was directly evolved from the first one. And one of the seven CDK inhibitor genes I mentioned was the one called the P16. It is the most frequently mutated in human cancer. In 40% or more of human tumors, the P16 gene locus is mutated or just gone. Mm-hmm. It's the second most frequent mutated gene in human cancer, second only to the PB3 as the most frequent mutated gene, it's about half. So if you randomly take 10 different cancer patients, and the half of them has mutation in the PB3 genes, the other half probably have mutation in the P16 locus. That tells you how important those two genes are really are in terms of suppressing tumor from development. Mm-hmm. So during the study of P16 genes, which the one I mentioned yesterday and was first recognized in my early studies and was through the Cosmic Hub lab, it was discovered that the reason the P16 gene got such frequent mutation rate in human tumor is because it's a unique structure that the two genes sleeping together. It's very, very unique in the mammalian genome. Mm-hmm. It happens in very primitive organisms like a bacteria, but not in the mammalian cells. The two genes, and they really sit on top of each other. So they're using the same piece of DNA, but they translate slightly different in the so-called alternative reading frame. So the protein is very different. Therefore, the function is very different. So it's very unique. Hmm. And the question becomes, and if you got two genes together and this whole locus is gone, then which, the loss of which gene's function is the one responsible for the cancer development. So that leads to the study of the second gene and then overlapping with the first one called the P16, the second one called ARF. Mm-hmm. And we made a big discovery, and it's a very important one. I think that was back to 1997. Okay. There was a surgeon coming to working with my in my lab and his fellowship So he wanted to do some basic research in addition to his hospital job. His name is Wendell Yorbrook. And he brought his off project in the lab, really want to understand what he's doing. And between him and another person in the lab, Dr. Yanping Zhen, and we made a discovery that ARF binds to another protein called MDM2. So that made a lot of impact on the field, because MDM2 was already identified previously as a principal negative regulator of PV3. Mm. So now everything tied together. Mm. It goes like this, that during the normal cell growth, and the cell want to divide, they do not want the PV3 to function, because if a PV3 function, it will kill cell or stop cell from growing. So that's exactly the mechanism by which PV3 suppress tumor growth. When something is wrong, like say DNA is damaged or got too much oncogene, so PV3 will be caught up to do its job, to causing cell cycle rest, to stop them growing, or that's causing cell to die by suicide, mm-hmm. or we call it apoptosis, right? So that's why when the PV3 is mutated, and then the cell got a much higher chance to develop a tumor. But normally you do not want the PV3 to do its job, because if everything's fine, the cell won't grow. Otherwise, we won't be sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
So that job is taken care of by MDM2, which will bind with the PV3 to kill PV3. Everything's normal. But when things is not normal, and then ARF comes into job. So that finding of ARF bind to MDM2 stabilize PV3 was a major finding in the study of cell cycle in the tumor suppression field in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're happy to be part of it. The third area, and related to both first and the second one, and that's called the mechanism of protein degradation. The reason we got into this is because we know a lot of protein we've been studying involving cell cycle control and the tumor suppressions are being degraded at a very rapid rate. And that's essential, because when the cell cycle progress, it's an irreversible process. It can go forward, but not backwards. And it's very important that you keep on going forward, keep on cycling, but not backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And partly, that is being determined by this mechanism of protein degradation. So once a job is finished, say a DNA completes replication, or cell completes mitosis, and the cell would destroy completely the enzyme that initiate the process for DNA replication, precisely to prevent the cell going backwards,
mm-hmm.
to precisely for the reason to prevent the DNA from replicate again until it finished the next step, that is mitosis, or to complete the mitosis before the re-replicate DNA again. So that's very important. Because we all know the cell can only divide once only per each DNA replication, or vice versa. What that means is during each cell division, they replicate every genetic material once, but only once, no more, no less. They then must commit division, and then replicate again, then division, then replicate again, then division. So this is a very precise process. Okay? And if any deviations, the cell in trouble. So one of the main mechanisms to ensure this is through the destruction of key proteins for each step. So once the protein is destructed very rapidly, the cell cannot initiate this process again unless or until they finish the next step.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding the mechanism of protein destruction, although known for some time and has been quite evasive all these years, we know that happens by a process called the ubiquitin tagging. That is, if a protein want to be degraded, or if cell want to degrade the protein, it would put a ubiquitin tag under the protein, then put the second one on the first one, third on the second, the fourth on the third, so on and so forth. So within few seconds, the protein is being tagged with this long tail that we call the polyubiquitin chain.
Mm-hmm.
So once the protein is being tagged, then it will be picked up by a machinery called the proteasome, and chop into pieces, recycle into amino acid. So that second part I understand very well, but the first part was not for a long time. How cell knows at what time and what place a protein is being degraded, because you must degrade the protein at the right place and the right time, otherwise cell will be in trouble again, mm-hmm. right? So that's the question and have been bugged us for a long time, because a lot of protein in the cell cycle are regulated by this pathway, but we don't know how. And specifically what we're missing is this key enzyme called ubiquitin ligase. And so we made a contribution by discovering a specific protein, a ring finger protein, which we call the ROCK1. So that just doing the job. And it specifically, it activates a ubiquitin conjugating enzyme to put a tag on the protein.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three areas that we are engaging right now. The function or in vivo function of CDK inhibitor genes, the molecular mechanism of RPPV3 tumor suppression pathway, and the molecular mechanism of ubiquitin mediated protein degradations.
Right. Okay. Good. It seems clear then that one application of your research, or one possible application, would be the treatment of cancer and understanding it better, avoiding it. Are there other applications?
Yes. Especially the third applications, because I use cell cycle and the cancer as an example to illustrate how important of ubiquitin-mediated protein degradation really is in that process. But ubiquitin-mediated protein degradation is also involved in virtually degradation of any protein to which ubiquitin is being tagged. So you can imagine that process can be, and actually and is, used by many other cellular process. And so for that reason, and the people studying like a signal transduction, apoptosis, inflammatory disease, and the immune response, so on and so forth, and have a lot long-standing interest in understanding this process. Because the same enzyme of ubiquitin ligase can be used to the degradation of any other proteins in principle.
Mm-hmm.
The question is how it's being targeted. So the understanding of this very enzyme called the ubiquitin ligase have implications far beyond the cell cycle and the tumor suppression control.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, then that we've been initiated collaboration with a pharmaceutical company or biotech company and in San Francisco to working specifically how could we screen the drug compound to inhibit this enzyme, along with the development in understanding how each specific ubiquitin ligase is being utilized by what disease process. And in the long run, we are hoping that by having this compound in hand, we might specifically target protein degradation machinery in a selective way, so that at a certain point, can we selectively inhibit the degradation of one protein, thereby affecting that process or the disease development.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Any other applications?
Gene therapy is another target. And for example, I mentioned early on the gene I was working on called cyclin D.
Mm-hmm.
Cyclin D is the gene involved in the cell cycle control. When cell got too much D-type cyclins, these particular specific proteins, the cell will proliferate almost like in a deregulated manner or uncontrolled manner. And so the environment cannot control it. I mean, that's the reason behind amplification of this gene in about 40 to 50% of head and neck cancer and a quarter of breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if one can imagine or develop a method to degrade this amplified D-type cyclin proteins, you might stop the disease from continuing to grow. Mm-hmm. So if we can deliver a method destroy the cyclin D in those tumors, and that could have the profound implications. And that actually is indeed one of the things and a lot of people, including a couple of people in my lab, is working on to see whether we can specifically engineer. Whether we can engineer attack that can bind at one hand with cyclin D, let's say. On the other hand, it brings the ubiquitin ligase. So we can selectively target a specific protein for ubiquitination if we want. As I said, once a protein becomes ubiquitinated, being tagged by those ubiquitin, it then will be degraded.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can develop that method and introduce that method into like tumors, and then that could help us to prevent further development of the disease.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the one thing, and I got several people working with me, and the several people in the lab, they have long interest in the clinical setting. And the one is the Dr. Jorberg I mentioned, he himself is a surgeon and working the head and neck cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other is a doctor from Germany, waiting doctor from Germany, and he also has long interest into the cancer treatment, especially liver cancer treatment. Yeah. So they both are working on those kind of related method.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Where do you see your research going in the next 5 years?
Oh boy. So somehow this year I got a lot into thinking about these ones, and
mm-hmm.
I got to feel the cell cycle field compared with like in the 7 or 10 years ago or 5 years ago, become much more mature by now.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the translation is less exciting,
right.
And less new discoveries or fundamental discoveries as we've been witnessing and over the past 5 or 10 years.
Right.
And then, so I've been thinking about a lot where we're going from now. And so on one hand, I would say we will be continually working on the cell cycle control and the tumor suppression as I just described.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, and we are thinking and we actually initiate effort to get into the so-called proteomic studies, which means we're going to study specific biological questions by studying at genome scale. And the reason for that is obvious, is that in the genome project of a human and is near the completion. The whole genome sequence being determined, and
mm-hmm.
soon will be finished the annotation and the analysis. So we know all the genes in the genome pretty soon. And after that, in a year or so, we are going to know the whole map and the sequence of mouse genome. So knowing the sequence in itself now is not the difficult or obscure for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, the biological science has been carried out by individual lab on an individual gene basis. So each investigator studying a gene or a few genes that is related to functions. And it has not been performed on a scale of the whole genome, asking that in the network sense, the function of your genes. Because we know in the cells, it's not no gene is working just by itself. They're all working in a networking sense. They must
mm-hmm.
communicate each other. And so we don't have an overview how individual gene works by the limitation what we know. But that is changing right now. Yeah. So that's the one thing, and we are thinking to develop into proteomic studies. Just by first asking that the protein we'll be working on is interacting with wells in the cell, just taking a systematic approach, just purify those protein complexes one by one, and to get an idea that what other proteins are in association individually with the protein we're working on.
Right.
And then we are asking why other proteins associated with these proteins and they're doing what, for what function purposes.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. So a more sort of global systemic view, though.
Precisely.
Right. Okay. To what extent have you achieved your research goals that you set out, let's say in 1993 when you began your lab?
I guess you can say the bottle is half a full or half a fill.
Right.
Yeah. In a horizontal sense, and compared with the junior faculties, we start up at same time, work in a relatively comparable field, and if you use that as a judgment for the development of my career and the accomplishment made in my lab, I guess I have to say I'm relatively happy.
Mm-hmm.
But I also realize, on the other hand, and I have this personality just it's not easy to be satisfied.
Right.
It's not very easy. And I sort of setting up a relatively high standard for myself as well for my lab. And that's the one thing, and my colleague and my wife and reminded me all the time, is that that may not necessarily good for you just because you have high standard, and not necessarily always driving you to the higher productivity and accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, and I do say that we can do better and we should be able to.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a learning process. The first few years, and we don't know how to do it, and I spend the most time myself on the bench, and I have not learned early enough for the as a good teacher to train a student. I only learned later, in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it become increasingly more and more clear to me that recruiting good people into lab is probably more important than anything else, or maybe they're combined. Without enough and grant support or fund, research is difficult, and picking right the project is important, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But none of it is more important than recruiting good people.
Right.
Yeah, and train them well. Yeah, and really try to inspire them, not burn them out.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one thing I start learning now, and I think I'm doing on that front much better than I did 6 or 7 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a side issue, but I think it's important. Do you spend much time at the bench anymore?
Unfortunately not.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not been on the bench for a year by now. More than a year.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Do you miss it?
I miss a lot. It's just become impossible now, because when on the bench, what you really need to be focused cannot be disrupted. And there's no sense at all to do an experiment and then stop and then somebody else pick it up. While you go to pick up a phone, go to a meeting, come back and pick it again. And
yeah.
That's just not right away, as I see it, to do the experiment. And I've not been able to do the real experiment myself on the bench for more than a year by now.
Right.
Yeah, and I have a relatively big group right now. And it's fluctuating between at the peak of 18 people to right now 12 people. And in terms of productivity as well as for the training purpose, it's probably more efficient for me not to sit on the bench. And I've been asking people a lot and around for senior faculties.
Mm-hmm.
There are examples where the senior faculty is still sitting on the bench doing experiments. I ask them how they do that. The common answer is, and just ignore the people in the lab. If you really want to do the experiment on the bench, enjoy yourself. There are successful examples, people like Fred Sanger, the United Kingdom, and he was still doing the DNA sequencing just before he was retiring, after he received twice Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And but then when he wrote his memo, the first thing he said is, and he felt somewhat guilty and selfish for not serving on any editorial duties, any administration jobs, and not writing many reviews. So you have to do those kind of, take those kind of approach,
right,
for being able to keep on the bench.
Right.
And generally speaking, that's probably not very good for the people in the lab. Okay. And so yes, you can do an experiment. There's a good part of it, and then you still have the direct feeling about result. But on the other hand, and the people in the lab, they don't get enough time to discuss with you.
And mm-hmm.
I still think the advice in the lab, or the peer in the lab, being the first person to be interacted with from the angle of graduate student or postdocs. But if you spend too much time traveling or on the bench yourself, they're not receiving enough from you.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Your lab has been up and running for about 7 years. What has been the impact, or what was the impact of the Pew Scholar or the Pew Fellowship on your research?
There are three measurable impact I can see it by being a Pew Scholar. So one is giving me a sense of confidence as to how well I'm doing and on a national scale. Because as a junior faculty, and you did pretty well, you must have done pretty well and, from your postdoc training. But you never know, and how much of that success is because of you, is because of the institution you're associated with, and the more important is because you're supervisor, your postdoc mentor.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. And writing a grant and getting an award and after becoming independent is the first indication or measurement and of your own. So for all that, and receiving a Pew Award and tells me that yes, compared with my Pew and my colleagues nationwide, and I am doing pretty well. And because the Pew Scholar was selected from the comparable level of junior faculties within less than 5 years of the starting faculty positions, they are all more or less on the same line of the career. So they're pretty comparable. Mm-hmm. And not mention that then the Pew Scholar nomination was only to like, I heard it was like limited to 80, the, and the both the prestigious medical school around the country. So you're really compared with the best group of young junior faculty around the country. And the second, of course, is the money issue. And so that's come very early on, the $200,000, and using as your discretion and any we want, no restriction.
Right.
And the supplement encourage very well for you to take some kind of relatively risky and approach, something that there's no guarantee. Because science is exploding by its nature of explosion, is looking for something that may or may not be there, and otherwise wouldn't be scientific research. But when the money, when the funding is tight, and the people take a safe approach to convince the review that yes, and if you give me money, I definitely will get something done based on this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
But that not necessarily means the best of science. The best of science, you have to take the risk, and doing something that may not give you anything. And but without the financial support, you cannot afford that, especially for the junior faculty. So in that sense, the pure money does encourage junior faculty like me to take approach. For example, specifically, it's knockout project. I probably would have hesitant to initiate. It costs money. It may or may not give anything. If there's no phenotype, and after knocking those genes out, we may not learn a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's costly. And they take a long time. And you know that minimum for 2 years, you're not going to publish anything. Right? So the pure money helps that. And the third thing is the impact to the campus. And when I first come here, and the UNC Chapel Hill Medical School, or the campus-wise, was really pushing up the biomedical research on this campus. It has a critical mass and building up very rapidly before I arrived here. So one thing they're missing is in the high quality of junior faculties. And they've been recruiting some people, and the quality varies and from year to year. But they really want to recruit some high-quality junior faculties. And I was the first Pew Scholar and nominated and awarded from this campus. So that made everybody happy, and they actually very encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, and they actually supported me further, realizing they have pretty good junior faculty on this campus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they feel very happy about it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, have you gone to the general meetings that the Pew has given?
Yeah, I've been attending every single annual Pew meeting.
Right,
yeah.
And are they useful, those meetings?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not to mention that there is this exotic place.
Right. That's also a benefit.
Right. Yes, because we normally don't go to a meeting like that. The Pew Scholar was selected from a wide range of fields, ranging from cell biology to immunology, developmental biology, structural biology.
Mm-hmm.
When we attend a meeting, we only attend a meeting specialized field that related to what we are working on. We don't usually listen to people outside the field. So that actually narrow your vision. So Pew Scholar gathering and the discussion is pretty wide range.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to understand sometimes because if you're not in that field, but they really force you to sit there to listen to something that you don't normally read or listen to. And it give a chance for people to get to know each other, to interact with each other. And in a such intimate setting, and you feel that you belong to a class. And I like that term, called class 94, class 95.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the most close relationships you could have is with your classmates. And so you can't have any closer than that. And know each other in personal ways different from knowing each other from just reading each other's paper.
Right.
For that sense, and we do feel, and I'm not exceptional, that and among Pew Scholars, we somehow feel that we have closer relationship to each other. So when we call each other, request material, asking information and discussion, and then it instantly create a much more friendly and openly communication.
Right.
Yeah. If we can relate each other by the association with Pew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. The next couple of questions are general, and they're about the biomedical research. The first one would be, if you could talk a little bit about the impact of technological innovation on research.
It's almost impossible to over describe that.
Right. Okay.
And the biomedical research, and as a one discipline of science, has one distinction from other science we know of, such as chemistry or physics. And the people probably remember early on this golden age, at the turning of the last century for the quantum physics development.
Mm-hmm.
It's purely theoretical. And early those days, all you need is a calculator and a piece of paper and a pen to calculate.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less that's the case. It was not until late, and then once the theory ground is laid, and then people needed to build up accelerator and those big machines to test those theories, become more and more experimental. And a very similar situation happened to molecular biology early on in the 1940s and the 50s, and before the double helix DNA structure was resolved, and people do a lot of postulation. If you read those early papers, including the similar workers by people like Jim Watson or Craig. And it's one speculation based on another. It's more of speculation and the postulation, serialization, and then actual fact.
Right.
But that stage is over. We still need a theoretical and guidance for our work, but it's more and more emphasis on the experimental approach. When it comes to the experimental approach, so the method and the technique become a limiting factors.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's just again and again, it's constantly that the breakthrough in the technology field and has such direct impact to the whole field of biomedical research. And there's just so many examples like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think I need just this one. For example, the PCR technique. It's purely just a technique. And for that, and they award a Nobel Prize for that method. And then and I think nobody would argue with that one.
Right.
And that's just and the impact of almost every field of molecular biology today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine, too, that makes it a little bit harder, too, to do bench work with the idea that because there's so much change technically,
uh-huh.
it's hard to keep up. Or do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, so we had a lot of discussion in the lab, and I myself and have been thinking that issue quite a bit.
Right.
So my commission right now on that issue is that if your question and is being blocked by a technology development, that you cannot really go further unless you adopt the technique, then learn the technique. Okay, so keep up with the technology development.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat the technology. Just keep up.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's so important. Just don't run away, no matter how new technique. It is a challenge
yeah.
to many people, because people have this tendency that if I know something pretty well, if I'm good on something, and you have this tendency to keep on doing the same thing over and over and over again, and very soon you'll be outdated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I emphasize so much and to the people in the lab that if we know there's a technology out there, and it's pretty well established, but we don't know anything about it, and there's obvious implication to our research, and don't bypass it, learn it,
right.
and setting up, establish it. And I put so much emphasis on this one, and I think the whole lab is now starting to benefit from it. And one of the major strengths in the proposal I wrote and in the last cycle of my funding application is the technology strength. We are at the cutting edge of utilizing all those techniques.
Right.
And so I emphasize so much on this one. And you got to be able to do the best and use the best technology available to address the questions. Otherwise, you are just simply handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. in looking through your CV and reading through some of your papers, you collaborated with a few people. Could you give us sort of an overview of those collaborations?
Yeah, and that's precisely related to the question of the technology development, because now the things develop so fast, and it's really required the ability of individual principal investigator can horizontally collaborate with other investigators while they are continue to develop their own research in the vertical way. And we are each studying a specific question, specific field, all right? But as this develops, it is ultimately and will connect it and with many other fields, especially what we're doing. It's a fundamental question is how the cell cycle or cell proliferation is being regulated. Mm-hmm. But the cell proliferation itself and has intrinsic connection to many other cellular processes, ranging from developmental biology, tumor suppression, and cell senescence, so on and so forth, and which I don't know anything about it, and back to several years ago. And there are two choices. Either you just stuck to this very narrow defined field of your own, keep on doing the same thing and to see whether you can go down. Or you make horizontal connections by interact and collaborate with other investigate and from different field. And it's become increasingly clear now that and there is an interdisciplinary connection, interdisciplinary interaction, collaboration is the way that discovery is being made. Yeah.
And that trend is probably only going to increase.
It's going to only increase more and more so. Mm-hmm. And because and the knowledge and the information accumulated in a such faster pace, no one can possibly know everything. And unlike earlier days in the 1940s, 1950s, and the one could say, well, I read every single paper in the field of molecular biology. Mm-hmm. That's not exaggeration. There were only so paper you can publish, you could read. And nowadays, nobody can even say that I read all the papers in my field. Yeah. I can say I read every paper in the cell cycle field. That's impossible. And so you can possibly know everything. And so the only way to do that is keep on doing what you're good at and then keep your eye open. And once you know there's an important connection there, and go out, read it, and find the best people you can to collaborate with and learn from experts.
Okay.
Yeah. I must say that I've been so fortunate to have been in this campus. One of the things is and it's big biomedical research community here. There's so many experts. And something you just can't possibly predict where you're going to develop in the next few years. But if you go to good campus, has high quality research, has critical mass like this, you know there's a good chance, and once you get that point, and the expertise will be available there. And it's been again and again, that's been the case.
Right.
Yeah.
The flip side of collaboration is competition, and you were talking about how crowded this particular field is, cell cycle field. What are, is competition, how can I phrase this, what are the pros and cons of competition?
Yeah, there's clear and the pros and cons on the competition.
Right.
Overall, it's probably good for the public.
Right.
Because the competition is really driving the discovery. And we all have our own egos. If there's no competition, then we can do the science like Mendel, and 100 years ago, and stay in the church, and in his backyard, studying beings development.
Right.
And yes, that can make a discovery, but it will be very slow pace. And if the discovery is made slowly, then the biomedical translation or the benefit to the patient will be slower too. Okay, so overall, it's good. It's good, but this the other side as well. The other side is when the competition becomes too much, it generates stress on the young investigators, myself included, and that may or may not be the best thing. And I know it's definitely not the best thing for the young student. They feel that they might get a burnout, and so I got to be careful on that part.
Right.
And the second is it lose some traditional scientific research, and the traditional scientific research, especially early days, like in the early 90s, and when the quantum physics developed, and people gathering around and the ball, and such open collaboration discussions, and the early days of and the molecular biology and development, and people getting together and they openly discussing unpublished result. That's a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But that become more and more clearly decreasing nowadays. And for a number of factors, one of them is the publication speed, really speed up. And the second, people are afraid of competition or screwed up. They are pretty reluctant to discussing something that are not published yet or mm-hmm. has not been accepted for publication. So that kind of situation actually impaired somewhat collaboration, which would otherwise accelerate the discovery. Yeah. But overall, I would say it's good things for the biomedical research.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, because publications have sped up, people are rushing to try to get their results, so they're not scooped. Has the quality, then, of the research, do you believe, gone down in the last couple of years?
Individually, and then maybe, and then not necessarily the quality to go down, is and a lot of experiment was a little bit rushed, incomplete.
Right.
Okay, and if given more time, it could be more thorough being conducted, right? But I'm not really concerned too much right now because the science research is a more or less self-policing discipline.
Right.
Because I would tell people that if it's something very trivial, not important, and the thing is incomplete and not correctly interpreted or even falsely interpreted, I don't think it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't think it's a big deal because what's the impact if nobody cares? But on the other hand, if some important discovery is being reported and that was not appropriately controlled or missing some controls or was not correctly interpreted or was using not well-accepted material, okay. In any of those cases, if it's an important discovery, and which means a lot of people are attending to it, and right away, they're going to develop on your discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And to further develop on the pre-discovery, and the first thing one must do is repeat the experiment. So right away, it's being discovered, if it's not right. Yeah, so if there's incomplete there, and this, I'm not concerned too much, and the people can discover right away.
Right.
But if it's not important, who cares? Yeah, so overall, as a whole, for the biomedical research and so that has not been a huge issue.
Right.
And of course, and the ethic has been very high. And so that one thing, and as a whole community, I think we are, and I have to say that as a scientist, as a whole, we are holding very high standard, extremely high standard. And I have not seen any other community, in the business or lawyer or policy, anything like that, have nearly such high criteria as we do,
right.
And self-imposed in many cases. So a few years ago, if you remember, there was this and the interference from the Congress, the policy got into this one. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally unnecessary. And the scientists have been doing science for 100 years, and just view how things was developed. Once in a while, and there might be a fabrication come out and from somewhere, but if it's not being detected, which means and it's not going to have any impact, it's not important.
Right.
I'm not saying it's good, but if it is important and it will be discovered very quickly, it's not going to be and escape.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, in the rush to publish, one possible effect is that people get scooped. Has that happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, it's just pretty easy and to get scoped. So we're doing things fast, but we also, sometimes we're not doing things fast enough, right? I have a lot of examples like that. For example, when I first come here, the one I posted in my lab was purified this gene and the tenable CDC37. So we have a difficulty to get the protein sequence. So we have a difficulty to clone that gene quickly enough. So finally, by the time we clone the genes, I got a phone call from my friend saying that the paper is already in press. Well, what do we do? Stop doing it. Yeah, I mean, we just got the gene, we haven't even started yet. And after 6 months, I mean, the paper is already in press.
And actually two papers, they sell the paper and they come out that even earlier than that one. So we just stop. Yeah.
Being a principal investigator, you have several responsibilities, or quite a few, in fact, as you probably know all too well. Do you teach? Are you teaching?
Yeah, we do doing some teachings as a professor, and but it's not much.
Right.
And being at a medical school, we don't have a formal teaching duty to undergraduate college.
Right.
And unlike the people in the Department of Biology of Art and Science and school. So I'm teaching graduate courses, and for myself and my teaching load is about 10 to 12 a year.
Right.
And that concentrated within the frame of 4 weeks. And actually 3 weeks, yeah, 4 weeks, and it's done. So that's not too bad.
Right.
And it's pretty low, a pretty light load. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. And do you enjoy teaching?
I love it. I love it, and it's probably can trace back my early teaching days when I was in countryside, and during the days of Cultural Revolution, and I taught middle school for a few years, and I had a very good relationship with those kids I was teaching, and I myself has a very close relationship with my teachers as well, and I was inspired of them, and I respect them. I just feel still up to these days, and the benefit and having good teachers. And the one thing is, and have a close relationship, has direct interaction instead of like a formal teaching. And you dress up and you feel distant from the student. So that's not the way I like it.
Right.
So I like it. And overall, I was also encouraged a lot by the teaching. And I've been done, the evaluation I've been receiving from the class been teaching here. And every year I've been number one in my class I was teaching, four of us. And I was joking, and I said, with the other three factors, and the one where you guys catching me up is by changing from speaking English to speaking Chinese. Yeah.
So why do you think you've gotten such high evaluations? What is it that you do?
Well, I think probably it's because of my enthusiasm. And so when I go up to the podium and teaching the class, and I feel excited.
Right.
And that intrinsically infects the student.
Yeah.
And I speak loud and I speak in very exciting sense. And also I bring them up and the feeling that what we are learning today and is directly connected to the public health.
Right.
So I can, the topic I was teaching, such as like the retrovirus, which carries oncogenes, and one retrovirus is HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So they all know what the impact is that. And I was also covering oncogenes and tumor suppressions, and we all know that cancer is a pretty terrible disease. And so by teaching those topics, by making connection and to students, and what we're doing in the laboratory, on the bench, has a direct impact, and not in the long future, but in the near future,
mm-hmm.
to the public health. And that can exciting students feel that what they're doing, what they're learning, and what they want to do in the future is a noble cause. Yeah, so that makes me feel very positive about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you run your class?
I spend a lot of time to prepare it, and then to compensate my language and the shortage, the part and I suppose it's not the best part I am. And also, and I speak very fast, and so I'm concerned a student may not be able to catch up what I say.
Mm-hmm.
So I prepare very well my hand notes. And so what I told them in the beginning of my classes, and if you just listen to me carefully, you don't have to take much notes, because all those complicated figures or formulas or tables, and I'm already printed out, so you can have it. You don't have to write down those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So my handouts is very clear, and the lecture is very organized. And make sure the flow from one lecture to next is well connected. And instead of teaching point by point, I try to teach them along a line so they can connect, they can interpret and the what they learned today and using what they learned and a few weeks ago. So those kind of connections are very important.
Right.
And the third, keep on update, keep on contemporary. So make a student feel excited. And they might hear this discovery, and a few weeks ago on CNN or reading Time magazine, then they realize, oh boy, this is where from.
Right.
So that makes them feel good. And a few years ago, and there was this cover story that PB3 was being named the year, the mark of the year on the cover. That's a big story on the, and once or twice a year on HIV and the cancer. And if you read the contents, a lot of discovery was on the molecule I was teaching, like a PB3, right. P16, ARF.